North Korea tests a hydrogen bomb. Maybe. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. North Korea claims it tested an H-bomb, but not everyone believes that.
The analysts I've spoken to today and the South Korean military have all said that it was not an H-bomb because the size of the explosion just wasn't big enough.
Plus, turning the Oregon militia standoff on its head.
If 15 Muslim Americans held up a 7-Eleven while drinking masala slurpees holding BB guns, I think you'd have some presidential candidates right now suggesting that they carpet bomb the parking lot.
And shh, don't tell the grown-ups. Comics are good for you.
When you teach kids to read comics, you're really teaching them to interact with information in this very complex way.
It's all today on The World. Not even a full week into the new year and literally explosive news, North Korea triumphantly announced it had successfully tested a hydrogen bomb today. The news was carried on North Korean state TV in its usual style.
Statement of the government of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. The test of the first hydrogen bomb of Joche, Korea is completely successful, a great event noteworthy in the 5,000-year-long history of the nation has happened.
Pyongyang dubbed it the H-bomb of justice for use in self-defense against the U.S. But the thing is, no one's quite sure what North Korea detonated today. The White House condemned the blast, but said its initial analysis was inconsistent with a successful hydrogen bomb test. The Washington Post's Anna Fifield is in Tokyo, and she's on the story. So, Anna, was it or was it not an H-bomb?
That's the million-dollar question right now. We don't know yet. The signs are that it was not. The analysts I've spoken to today and the South Korean military have all said that it was not an H-bomb because the size of the explosion just wasn't big enough. It looks much more in line with the nuclear tests that happened between 2006 and 2013. But right now, there are American and Japanese sniffer planes out there trying to pick up any radioactive gases so they can tell more about this test. And also the seismologists will be poring over all of the data so they can try and estimate the size of this. So in the next few days, possibly next few weeks, we will have a much better idea of this.
Now, South Korean lawmakers seem to know that this bomb or this explosion was about 6 kilotons, which is, from what I've read, less than half the power of the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. If it is, whatever this thing is it something North Korea would actually use in real life?
Well, that's the real question. We know that they have a nuclear capability. We've known that for some time. But are they able to deliver it? That's the question that we haven't been able to answer. North Korea has boasted that it has been able to make nuclear weapons small enough to fit on a missile. And some American military chiefs also think that its technology has probably advanced enough. But again, we don't know. As with so many things about North Korea, we won't know until they actually do it. So there's a lot of questions marks hanging over this. But regardless, I mean, there's no doubt that today, even if it was a plain old vanilla atomic test that they conducted, it was a very serious provocation from North Korea, and they're really throwing down the gauntlet to the international community.
Right. Some watchers have speculated that this is in advance of marking Kim Jong-un's birthday. Kind of seems like a weird way to commemorate it, but why do you think this is happening now?
Well, we have to remember this is a guy who once commemorated his birthday with Dennis Rodman on a basketball court.
So
begin to describe how North Korean leaders celebrate their birthdays. Yes, it is Kim Jong-un's birthday, probably his 33rd birthday on Friday. And generally, leaders' birthdays are celebrated with a lot of fanfare in North Korea. I think a much more likely explanation is that this is all part of the lead-up to the Workers' Party Congress, which will be held in May this year, which is a very important occasion, and it hasn't been held for 36 years. So this is going to be a really big deal. Chances are Kim Jong-un would like something to crow about, some major achievement that he can hold up to the party as a way to kind of bolster his legitimacy and to tout his credentials as a leader, even though he is so young.
You know, it occurred to me that we dwell so much in this absurdist side of North Korea, you know, summed up in comedies like The Interview and Team America, and then something deadly serious like this happens. What does it feel like psychically sitting in Tokyo, knowing that potentially a nation described as rogue might be testing an H-bomb in the neighborhood? What does that do to your head?
I've been covering North Korea for many years, so I've become maybe like South Koreans, a little immune to this, or to think that this is bluster, that they won't do anything. But, you know, again, like with the testing, we won't know until they do it. I think that, I mean, for North Korea to do anything more than testing would really be suicidal for them. That would, if they fired a nuclear armed missile somewhere, that would be inviting the kind of repercussions that, you know, that would be, yeah, suicidal for them, that would maybe spark an invasion or something. So I think that, yeah, that's not really a question that people ask here so much, actually, I have to confess.
Anna Fifield, Tokyo Bureau Chief for The Washington Post, thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
No surprise, perhaps, that Japan and South Korea have condemned the test, but China has also spoken up, and sharply so. The World's Mary Kay Magstad is our former correspondent in Beijing. How surprised are you by the Chinese reaction, Mary Kay?
Well, the Chinese have been less than happy with Kim Jong-un for quite a long time. They don't necessarily want North Korea to be acting out in this way on an ongoing basis, which it's been doing for as long as I've been covering China over the course of 20 years. Basically, what happens is when North Korea feels that it's not getting the attention it wants, it's not getting the aid it wants, it feels threatened in any way, it'll play this card. It's the one card that it really has to play. And usually it does get some kind of a response that works in its favor. That's been less the case under the Obama administration. President Obama finally figured out something that previous presidents hadn't, which is the more we give in, the more they're going to do this.
Mm. And doesn't China typically get kind of like a little warning before these things happen? And the fact that that didn't happen this time, how significant is that?
There isn't always a warning. And in fact, in the past, China has done things like cut off North Korea's oil supply for 3 days when it's been unhappy with something North Korea has done. The perception from outside continues to be that China is North Korea's closest ally. The actual relationship between the two has been uneasy for quite a long time. China's been wanting North Korea to move in the direction of economic reform, open up, you know, be a better neighbor, a better partner. And Kim Jong-un just has his own ideas about how he'd like to move forward.
So I'm not inclined to turn to Donald Trump as a pundit on the Korean Peninsula, but he said today China should be on point on this issue because he says China, quote, totally controls North Korea, end quote. Is that true?
Not entirely. It had been true for quite a long time that North Korea got most of its fuel and much of its food aid from China and then some from South Korea. And China certainly does have some leverage, but it doesn't have as much leverage as I think the outside world thinks it does. Now, what is true inside North Korea is that there is little or no economic growth. The infrastructure is breaking down. There's been next to no investment in the infrastructure. There's a million-man army. There's artillery all along the border with South Korea. So there's limited room for reaction of the military sort, certainly. Also, China looks at North Korea as a buffer between itself and U.S. troops in South Korea. So it does not want to cause chaos in North Korea that could cause a vacuum that could allow U.S. troops to come in. So China's potential moves are also somewhat limited by those considerations.
So if China is unhappy, does that imply perhaps that there might be an effective international response to this nuclear test by North Korea, if that's what it is?
Right. So there's always the question of what is an effective international response. And one of the more effective ones in the past has been going after goodies that could go to the top 200 elite families in North Korea, the few people at the top of the party who want to have access to their money overseas, want to have access to luxury goods coming in, want to be able to travel.
I was going to say DVD players in Courvoisier.
Right, because it's not like the rest of the country is a thriving economy and that, you know, sanctions could really put a squeeze on what's happening in that sector.
Mary Kay, when you were in China, did saber-rattling in North Korea, did it just stop the country in its tracks for a few days? And did it ever get routine?
It kind of got routine, yeah. There were regular threats from North Korea every couple of years at least. And it got to the point where it's like, okay, so this is what they're doing again. They're playing that card. They recognize that they can get something when they do it. And in fact, North Korea's official news agency just in the past few days said, why would you drop your sword when there's a pack of wolves coming at you? So that's how they see it.
Yeah.
You know, we've got this nuclear deterrent. We're not giving it up. And in fact, we're just going to remind people every so often that we have it and we can do something with it. So you need to take us seriously. You need to treat us with respect. And by the way, if you'd like to give us some aid, that would be good, too.
All right. We'll leave it there. The World's Mary Kay Magstad. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The U.S. and other countries are now scrambling to find out what kind of bomb went off in North Korea. So what kind of analysis does it take to figure that out? David Albright is president of the Institute for Science and International Security. Help us out here, David Albright. As we heard earlier from Anna Fifield, the U.S. and Japan have sent sniffer planes to analyze the atmosphere off the coast of North Korea. What exactly are they looking for, and can what they find make the kind of irrefutable determination on whether it was an H-bomb or not?
Well, the idea is to try to intersect a plume of radiation that would come from the test site. And you can learn about the atomic bomb pretty easily if you can actually detect the radioactive material. On the thermonuclear question, it's a little harder. But again, you may find some evidence in the plume of a thermonuclear reactions. This whole process, though, is very difficult in the case of North Korea because North Korea has a history of trying to keep us from being able to learn about its tests.
Right.
And so they go to great lengths to try to minimize the amount of radioactive material that comes out of the test site or try to have it come out in a very slow way so that it's dispersed on different days and very hard to detect.
That must be a real challenge for North Korea. I mean, a lot of experts believe they are detonating this as a kind of show of military theater. At the same time, they don't want to let too much information out.
No, that's right, because they want to control the information. You know, is it an H-bomb? With seismic information, you can get a rough estimate of the yield. We know it's closer to 10 than 25 kilotons.
Right, so, and the U.S. Geologic Survey recorded a seismic wave equivalent to 5.1 magnitude.
That's right. That's like the same magnitude of the 2013 tests, roughly around 10 kilotons. And so that's not a thermonuclear weapon. It's certainly not what people think of as an H-bomb, which destroys a city and it's hundreds, if not thousands, of kilotons.
Hiroshima was like 15 kilotons, right?
That's right, 15. And nuclear weapons are horrifically destructive, but a thermonuclear weapon has the potential to destroy cities. And so it's a much more threatening weapon. But at 10 kilotons, this can't be an H-bomb.
What about the possibility that North Korea has successfully engineered a miniaturized hydrogen bomb?
Well, I think the miniaturization question in my mind is settled, that they can miniaturize. But there are other types of what one would call H-bombs. We call them thermonuclear weapons that are simpler. And the worry in the case of North Korea is that maybe they are working on this one-stage thermonuclear weapon and they ignited some of the thermonuclear material, but it didn't contribute significantly to the yield. But it was potentially working.
What about satellite imagery or any other data from the air? Is there evidence there about what caused this explosion?
Not so much. You look to see if there was evidence of rock slides, which would suggest a higher yield. Mm. But it's really not going to give you much information about the type of weapon detonated. Often the satellite imagery is useful to detect preparations for a test and didn't work very well this time. I mean, I think we all who look at this knew a test was going to occur at some point. But we were surprised that it happened today, and at least one government told me in an honest moment they were surprised too. And again, North Korea may not want us to know, and they may have taken extra precautions. So we need to go back in our own analysis and see if there were indications of a test that we just missed.
So how long do you think it'll be before we have a satisfactory answer on what actually happened in North Korea?
I'm not optimistic we'll know.
Ever?
Yeah, I'm not optimistic we'll find radioactive debris. I hope we do. I mean, over time, we'll probably learn more. But right now, North Korea wants to control the information and try to convince the world that they now have H-bomb capabilities.
Why should we not believe that? Because, I mean, that kid at Princeton wrote his senior thesis in the 1970s on how to make an atomic bomb. Shouldn't everybody have access to the recipe?
Designing a bomb, paper study is a lot easier than actually building one. And to get all this to work in a nuclear explosion where everything's happening in microseconds is tricky.
Does this mystery-solving business happen every time North Korea detonates something?
Yes. It's a game, an intellectual game, to try to figure out fact from fantasy. And it's very tough. And you have to be patient because the answers often don't come quickly.
David Albright, president of the Institute for Science and International Security, thank you very much for talking to us about this.
Sure. Thank you. Take care.
Later, when avant-garde rock met avant-garde classical, or you could say when Pierre met Frank. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Authorities in Oregon say they're still hoping for a peaceful resolution to the standoff there. A group of armed men has been occupying a national wildlife refuge in the state since Saturday. That wait-and-see response from law enforcement has prompted some to wonder what would happen if those 15 or 20 armed occupiers were, say, Muslim. I asked author and journalist Wajahat Ali to chime in here.
If 15 Muslim Americans held up a 7-Eleven while drinking masala Slurpees holding BB guns, I think you'd have some presidential candidates right now suggesting that they carpet bomb the parking lot and or send in a drone strike. But currently, you know, I have to actually, Marco, owe an apology to a failed presidential candidate, Bobby Jindal, because he was right, Marco. There are apparently, quote, no-go zones in America. I mean, look at Burns, Oregon, where non-assimilationist community of armed, bearded, dangerous men are keeping out mainstream Americans by occupying land and implementing their version of American Sharia. But of course, as we just learned, they're on a mission from God. But unfortunately, they're not the Blues Brothers. I mean, and this is the situation we have right now in America.
Joking aside, I mean, you talk about the double standards, and I've been seeing this a lot on social media. Who's a terrorist and who's not a terrorist? Who's a patriot? Who isn't? Why is there this misconception about who's a terrorist and who's a patriot?
I mean, it deals with, unfortunately, the double standard that exists in this community when it comes to minority communities, communities of color. You know, mainstream America, of course, always means white. And there is a problem with whiteness in America. And whiteness, I mean, is the ideology of supremacy based on exclusion. And what we're seeing right now, especially with the media response, I think also with law enforcement response and also the political response to what's happening in Burns, Oregon, it manifests itself. There's a deep discrepancy. There's a divide that exists in what should be a fair, just, equal America.
What about the discussion in the presidential race? I mean, it's early on in the campaign. We know it's a time when bluster is cheap. Where's the presidential race taking this debate?
I think the presidential race will unfortunately exacerbate this debate. I mean, just look, recently Trump doubled down yet again, released his first TV ads in which I think Morocco doubled as Mexico.
Right.
Because, of course, Morocco is Mexico. Both countries start with M, brown people. You know, who cares about specifics? And he says we have to worry about this illegal invasion. And he doubled down on his Muslim threat and said that he would keep away 1.6 billion people temporarily from entering the United States. I wonder if that also includes Dave Chappelle, who's on a comedy tour. And I wonder if that also includes Muslim veterans and soldiers fighting in Iraq and Syria. But, you know, and also, by the way, will that include Saudis and rich Gulf types who are basically, as you know, hiring Republican diplomats and lawmakers and lobbyists in Washington, D.C. right now. So I wonder if those paychecks will still come in. But I digress. I think very clearly what we're seeing is a deliberate, cynical manipulation of this fear, of this ignorance, of Islamophobia, of anti-immigrant bigotry. The Republican Party, you know, said that they had to court minorities after losing in 2008, but instead it has gone more extreme to the right, and the center has shifted to the right. And it does worry me considerably because you do have growing disaffected white voters whose fears, legitimate fears maybe about the economy, about national security, are being preyed on by politicians who should know better to get votes. And unfortunately, like I said before, this will affect the national security and the character and identity of all Americans and really make us confront whether or not we can achieve the American dream in 2016. Will we allow ourselves to be divided along religious and ethnic lines, or will we employ the best of our American values to come together as a pluralistic nation? It is a scary time.
You're a father yourself, Wajahat. What crosses your mind when you think about your kid growing up in the climate that you just described?
You know, I mean, I'm a multi-hyphenated dude, the son of Pakistani immigrants, and the worst thing that I was called growing up was Gandhi, which is actually a compliment. But meanwhile, I mean, really, I'm like, thank you. Yeah. You're comparing me to a pacifist leader who, along with others, pretty much ended 300 years of colonialism and helped usher in two nation states in 1947.
Yeah,
awesome.
Thank you.
Win. Yeah, thank you. But for my son, you know, Ibrahim, I worry whether or not his loyalty will always be questioned, whether or not he will have to engage in these endless condemnathons whenever a violent extremist commits a violent act in a country that he's never visited. You know, will he be seen as authentically American due to his mocha caramel skin and his multi-hyphenated name? And can he emerge as the protagonist, a baller protagonist of the American narrative, or will he always feel besieged and burdened by these toxic narratives that drag minority communities down? And I'm hopeful. You know, I remain hopeful. I have to be hopeful. I'm an American. I was born and raised in this country. And I'm going to be damned if I'm going to let anyone tell me that the American narrative does not belong to me or my son just because he happens to be brown, multi-hyphenated, and Muslim.
Author and journalist Wajahat Ali, thank you very much, as always.
Thanks, Marco.
The classical music world lost a giant yesterday, Pierre Boulez. And yeah, we could go all highbrow on you now and give you the straight bio on him, how he was born in France in 1925, how he conducted some of the world's leading orchestras without a baton, and how he was known as an avant-garde composer. There, that's a straight dope on Pierre Boulez. Now we can highlight his collaboration with this man. Frank Zappa, legendary guitarist and composer, leader of the Mothers of Invention, doesn't really seem like a guy who wrote a song called The Illinois Enema Bandit would find common ground with someone like Boulez. Then again, I did own a Zappa album featuring music for electric violin and low-budget orchestra, and with the Zappa soundtrack to the movie 200 Motels, the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra got involved. There was also a brief collaboration in 1970 with conductor Zubin Mehta, but it went nowhere. Frank Zappa had long hoped his orchestral music would get treated seriously. Fast forward to the 1980s, and Zappa sent some of his scores to maestro Pierre Boulez, and Boulez accepted. And in 1984, the album Boulez Conducts Zappa, The Perfect Stranger, came out. Great title because for some in classical and rock circles, the collaboration was perfectly strange. Maybe not such a strange collaboration, though. Zappa was the head of the class in avant-garde rock, often teasing out classical and jazz strands in his music, while Boulez was always looking for the next challenge in modern music. Here's a sonic example, Frank Zappa's song Dupree's Paradise, performed live by the Mothers of Invention in Stockholm in 1973. But Dupree's Paradise was never recorded in the studio until Pierre Boulez got his hands on it. So there's your dose of music appreciation for the day. As for the late Frank Zappa and the late Pierre Boulez, may their breaking of musical conventions be the inspiration for others to do the same. It keeps life interesting. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, a hip-hop artist remembers what it took to break into the music business in Kenya.
I just know that when I started to make music, you just needed to know a guy. If you know the guy knows what needs to be done.
Now she's a star in Kenya. Her name, Muthoni the Drummer Queen. Her story is coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. A solemn anniversary in Paris this week. Tomorrow will be exactly 1 year since jihadist brothers Saeed and Sherif Kouachi gunned down 8 staff and several others in and around the building that used to house the offices of satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo. Other coordinated attacks followed that day. Today, Charlie Hebdo released a special edition with a typical thumb-in-the-eye cover, a gun-toting god figure, no specific religion, just a holy guy in sandals, stands with a Kalashnikov slung over his shoulder. The headline, 1 year on, the killer is still at large. The Vatican was not pleased. Our friend reporter Adeline Sia is in Paris. And Adele, what's been the reaction to the cover?
Well, Marco, as you mentioned, the god on the cover is kind of non-denominational. Charlie Hebdo follows in its grand tradition of equal opportunity offender, in a way, because anyone could be offended or everyone could just look the other way and say, well, you know, that's just what they do.
What else is in the special edition of Charlie Hebdo?
There's an op-ed from Laurent Sourisseau, known as RIS, who heads Charlie Hebdo, and he defends the cover, in fact, by saying precisely that Charlie Hebdo isn't, in fact, the only atheist paper in France. He says that fanatics who were brainwashed by the Quran and bigots from other religions are part of those who wanted to see the Charlie Hebdo cartoon is dead. But he said, in fact, the fact that the paper managed to survive a year on after this horrible tragedy is proof that the convictions of atheists and secular people can move more mountains than the faith of believers. Mm. That's what he wrote in the pages of his op-ed today. Mm. There's also a large drawing, interesting drawing, by artist Catherine Meurice. She represented the cartoonists from Charlie Hebdo in the scene from The Last Supper, the famous Da Vinci painting with its long table and all the cartoonists surrounding the table and sharing a meal. And Sharp, who was killed last year, says, "Verily, I say unto you, we're going to have a lot more laughs together for a very long time."
The cartoonists who were killed last year are being honored in a number of ways this week. But I gather there's been at least one slip up on one memorial.
Yes, in a way, it's maybe a fitting tribute to the paper. The memorial plaque that was affixed to the building of the former offices of Charlie Hebdo in Paris, of course, has the name of all the cartoonists, and the last name is Georges Wolinski. Wolinski, you spell the name with an I at the end. Only problem is on the plaque, it's actually spelled with the Y.
Oh, dear.
And I take it that Mrs. Wolinski herself was not amused. Obviously, you can understand that it's a bit insulting to find out that your late husband's name has been misspelled. But in fact, that created a buzz immediately on Twitter in a new hashtag, Je suis Charlie with a Y instead of Charlie IE at the end. And people were kind of, on the whole, pretty amused by the irony. And they thought that the cartoonists would have been very amused themselves by this huge slip up.
Yeah, ironic that a dead magazine writer didn't get an edit on his memorial plaque. There's also been some irony around how another cartoonist murdered that day is being memorialized, right?
Yes, Cabu, the late Jean Cabu, who was shot dead last year, is memorialized on the front page of Le Canard Enchaîné, which is another satirical newspaper in France, very well known, has been around since 1915. But the headline is quite funny because you see the face of Cabu and it says, "Cabu honored by the government and celebrated by the army and even sung by Johnny Hallyday, our French, very, very French rock star who's been around forever, and who wrote a song, a tribute to the march that took place just days after the Charlie Hebdo attacks last year, and has been asked to sing this song on Place de la République, a huge square in France where there's going to be another ceremony this Sunday. And the irony is that Cabu, of course, was not particularly, you know, in line with anything the government did. He was totally anti-army. And, of course, Johnny Hallyday was a singer that Cabu loved to hate. He just made fun of him any chance he had. So, again, this irony there that Le Canard Enchaîné really targeted very rightfully, more irony than crude humor.
Reporter Adeline Sear in Paris. Thank you very much, Adele.
Oh, you're welcome, Marco.
Still on the subject of comics, you could say, back in 2008, the Library of Congress created the post of National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. It's a 2-year position tasked with traveling around the country, showing kids that reading can be a vital part of their lives. This year, the honor went to Jean Luen Yang. He's the author of award-winning titles like Boxers and Saints and American Born Chinese. And I admit, I'm burying the headline here. Yang is the very first graphic novelist to be named to the post.
I think it's kind of a crazy thing. This is something that when I was growing up reading comics and dreaming of making comics that I never would have thought could happen. When I was a kid, the comic book industry and the quote-unquote traditional book industry were really two separate entities, you know, each with its own distribution system, each with its own rewards, each with its own stores. And over the course of the last 10 or 20 years, they've really merged together. I feel really lucky to be a cartoonist working at this time because I feel like I've really benefited from this merging.
And what about the readers, like the young readers that you are writing for? I mean, have you seen a change in recent years in the way young adults relate and react to graphic novels?
Well, I think, you know, the young readers nowadays are reading more comics than they ever have before. When I was a kid, there were just a handful of my fellow classmates who are reading comics. And now it seems like almost every kid in every classroom is reading comics. But they're just reading different kinds of books than I was when I was growing up. Nowadays, I think there's a much wider variety of types of stories that are available through the comics format. And the other big thing is a lot of parents and a lot of educators, and especially librarians, have really woken up to the fact that comics are this wonderful way of telling stories, that when you teach kids to read comics, you're really teaching them to interact with information in this very complex way.
Well, I think a certain generation of people would say comics are not literature, but maybe that's why they change it from comics to graphic novels. And there is something that's changed in the content of graphic novels, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, there are these three major comic book cultures in the world. There's us, there's the American one, there's one that's in Asia that's largely based in Japan, and then there's one in Europe that's kind of centered around France. And in those other two cultures, they've always told a diversity of stories. They've always had various genres represented in comics and graphic novels. It's only in America that comics have largely been associated with a single genre, with superheroes. And finally, we're seeing that break. You know, we're finally seeing the same kind of diversity here as they have in those other two cultures.
So you were the child of immigrants from China. Let's go back to when you were a kid. How did graphic novels connect you as a kind of second-generation immigrant to American culture?
Well, you know, I mostly grew up with superhero comics, and I was immediately drawn to them. I started collecting superhero comics when I was in the fifth grade, and I don't think I was conscious of this at the time, but I really believe that what drew me to superhero comics was this convention of having a dual identity. You know, Superman isn't just Superman, he's also Clark Kent. Batman is also Bruce Wayne. And this negotiation of identities that I saw on the comic book page reflected a negotiation of identities that I experienced as the child of immigrants. Wow. I grew up with two different names, one at home, the other one at school. I grew up with two different sets of cultural expectations. And again, I don't think I was conscious of it, but when I was reading about Superman and Clark Kent being the same person, I kind of felt that about me as well.
So was there anything missing from that superhero kind of theme that you as a writer and artist wanted to backfill?
Well, sure. I even though I could deeply relate to these characters, very few of them really looked like me. You know, I didn't grow up with a lot of Asian American superheroes. I think
were there any?
Yeah, there was Jubilee on the X-Men. X-Men has always been a fairly diverse super team. You know, there's Jubilee on the X-Men. They also had a guy named Sunfire. They had a lady named Psylocke who was born British, but then she was kidnapped by these ninjas and given an Asian body. So I kind of claim her as well.
Right.
But largely, there just weren't a lot.
So you've just gotten this two-year ambassadorship with the Library of Congress. What are you going to do with it? What does the Library of Congress want you to do?
I'm continuing a legacy that's already been established. The Library of Congress and the Children's Book Council and Every Child a Reader, those are the three sponsoring organizations behind it. They really want to raise awareness of reading in general. And that's what I'm going to be part of something that's much bigger than myself. You know, as an author, I get to do these different school visits and I get to talk to kids about books, but they're largely just my books. Now I get to talk to them about books in general. I get to talk to them about reading in general. I get to talk to them not just about graphic novels, but about the diversity of books that are available to them.
Jean Luen Yang, author of Boxers and Saints, an American-born Chinese, and now the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature at the Library of Congress. Thank you very much, Jean.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
New Year's Eve in the German city of Cologne was anything but festive. More than 90 women reported being sexually assaulted or violently robbed by gangs of young men. It happened near the city's main train station. The attacks appear to have been coordinated with as many as 1,000 men, yep, 1,000 men, gathering to attack the women. Most of the attackers were reported to be men of African or Arab origin. It's a story which has sent Germany into shock. Alexandra Oyl is an editor with the feminist magazine Emma, which is based in Cologne, and she spoke with one young woman who was attacked.
She's 26 years old, and she was just on her way home, and she wasn't expecting anything bad to happen to her. But she missed her train, and she already was just recognizing that something was strange, but she didn't take it that serious in the beginning. But as soon as she started waiting with a friend, she suddenly realized that that the whole main station was packed with hundreds of men, and that suddenly these men were just starting to harass them. They were touching them, they were talking to them, and were touching their breasts and trying to get the stuff out of their pockets. And when the girl said they should go away, they called them a bitch. And in the end, she was so confused. She said that she was even crying, and just tried to hold her stuff together. And then she went out of the main station. And
90 women have reported similar stories?
There were 90 reports about criminal acts in that night. And there was robbery as well and different stuff. And a lot of them were connected to sexual violence, yes.
Have there been any arrests or any charges?
Have there been any arrests or charges? During the night, the police didn't even recognize that women were harassed or that women were sexually kind of abused, and that there even was one rape that night. But then during the next days, the whole situation escalated because more and more women reported the assault to the police. The amount of women became clear within these days, and it's even getting more.
So how have people in Cologne been reacting, not just to the assaults, but also to those first hours where the police kind of, sounds like they kind of dropped the ball?
Well, the people in Cologne and obviously people all over Germany are really shocked about what happened there, because the sentence which is repeated over and over again is that this is like a new quality of crime. What we said is that it reminds us of things which happened to the Tahrir in the Tahrir place in Egypt some years ago.
During the Arab uprising, right?
Exactly, where exactly the same thing happened. Women were systematically abused, raped, happened. Groups of men surrounded the women, and the women we talked to, they just can't believe that this now just happened. It didn't just happen in Cologne. There were similar cases in other cities as well. We had calls from women from Stuttgart. We had calls from women from Hamburg. But the difference in Cologne is the amount of men being there, and they're not being afraid of behaving that way in public.
And the fact that the perpetrators in Cologne appeared to have been of African or Arabic origin, though apparently residents for many years, in most cases, in the city, what is that all about? What does that mean?
Well, the police are still investigating, because during that night, not a single man has been arrested because of sexual violence, because the police didn't even know what was happening there. What the witnesses said is that most of the men seemed to have a North Arabic or a North African background, but nobody really knows what kind of group was meeting there.
The mayor of Cologne has apparently proposed that women think about eine Armlänge, meaning keeping an arm's length distance from strangers. What do you think about that suggestion?
Well, when we heard a saying that, we were pretty irritated, actually, because it's a pretty naive way of explaining women how they can save themselves. She said, okay, you should just stay an arm length away from strangers. Other things she said was, okay, you should stay with your group and you should not be so open to people. I mean, you have to stop men abusing. That's the problem.
Alexandra Oyl is an editor with the feminist magazine Emma, based in Cologne. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much as well for talking to me.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. James Brown, when he wanted to open up some space for a drum solo, he'd often shout at the band, "Give the drummer some." Let's change that line for the woman you're about to meet. Let's just say the drummer is going to take some.
Madoni drummer queen!
This is the music of Muthoni, the drummer queen, and her song Naini Yahoo, which means, whose Nairobi is this? I met Muthoni Ndonga, her given name, outside a coffee shop in Nairobi a couple of weeks ago. That's when I was in Kenya with our Across Women's Lives project. We had a freewheeling conversation, and I wanted to share some of it with you. Muthoni, the drummer queen, is one of the wealthiest women in Kenya, and that did not happen by accident. Her pop singles get lots of airplay and YouTube play in Kenya. She's also an impresario. Her mobile party blankets and wine always sells out. So Muthoni is big in the recording studio and in her own boardroom. Meeting Muthoni for the first time, I asked her, how hard was it for a young woman to get a toehold in Kenya's music business?
I just know that when I started to make music, you just needed to know a guy. The system is a guy. If you know the guy knows what needs to be done. But there was no like company that could say, this is my record, do you want to buy it? Or I would like to publish the music. You needed to know a guy.
She knew she needed a guy to get that toehold, but artistically, she was well on the way from a young age. In high school, she picked up the drums. Not a Western drum kit. She drew attention because she picked up a traditional set of drums.
They're called Ohangla. And they're a set of six drums, and they're tuned differently, and they make these really good melodies. And in my view, they're the most braggadocious. They have so much vibe and character, and you can turn them around. And that community, the local community, in my view, have some of the best music from Kenya. So I really love these drums. But then, like, there needs to be, you know, this British black people that we are. They're not deemed to have much value. So when I say I'm a drummer, and so then people are impressed because they think I play the drum kit, I'm like, no, I don't play the drum kit at all. I have very basic understanding. I play this Ohangla, it's like,
So playing the Ohangla drums is Muthoni's way of rebelling against the history of British colonialism in Kenya. But Muthoni rebels against Kenyan conventions in other ways. The day we met, she was in jeans and a long-sleeve T-shirt that said, dope. Her hair was copper, she wore it in bangs, and the back of her head was shaved, leaving just a bit of copper stubble against her brown neck. I can assure you, that's not how most Kenyan women roll. Still, just hearing Muthoni call out Kenya for being conventional was a revelation.
Oh, this is the most square country you ever did see. It's square, you go to school, you get a job, you do this thing, you get married a certain time, and it really pretends. From the outside, we seem like we're this like really progressive, going ahead culture, and it's like, nah, not so much. We're very same. I really blame our education system. It bit the creativity out of us. Like, nobody has time for you to have personal ideas. We want you to read, cram, pass an exam, get a job in a bank, work your way up, aspire for a mortgage.
So you want to rebel against that?
Completely. Not I want to rebel. It's the idea of it is stifling. Even when I was in it, it didn't really make much sense. So it's, you know, like basic little things, like when we were in high school, we all had to have the same hairstyle. Okay. It's hair, guys, you know. It's like really, there's not that, like the hair doesn't change my understanding of mole theory, no, in chemistry. It's just, and so this little, I feel for me, the need to stifle individuality and personality out of people, it's a disaster.
Which may be partly why Muthoni takes some of her musical cues from some of the least square women in American music.
My rap idol is Missy Elliott. She's like my rap idol forever, ever and ever. And I'm so happy she's back. And she's just more, no? So for me, it's always been Missy. And then there's Lauryn Hill, because then what are we going to do about Lauryn? She's everything, no? And then comes along Nicki Minaj. And I have so many problems with Nicki's imaging, but I cannot fault anything about her delivery, and she's just so competent, she's just so good, she just doesn't get the props that she deserves. I feel like Nicki is permanently dealing with the glass ceiling in hip-hop for women in hip-hop in America, and all the complication around that, but she's great, she has great rhymes.
And in one of Muthoni's songs, she liberally borrows some of Nicki Minaj's lyrics. That That's Muthoni, the drummer queen's big hit in Kenya, Turn on the Lights, riffing off of Nicki Minaj's Bees in the Trap. It's things like that which prompted Muthoni several times during our interview to call herself crazy. And I asked her why she thinks of herself that way.
All the people that I have enjoyed listening to over the years are, I guess, people who've led the pack. I miss people like Erykah Badu, or just, they've authoritatively gone out and built the life that they desire on their own terms. And I really think that maybe that's where my crazy comes from. I just feel like you should. It's one life. Okay. Maybe there's a reincarnation, but you can't really bet on what you're going to come back as, no? Okay, so you can bet on this one life that you have, so you might as well get the most that you can, no? Okay, okay, babe. Watch out to one, the ten. Check what makes sense. Watch out for ten. Watch any ten, the ten. To come so far to lose it all is simply devastating. Why are we separate? I'm here negotiating. The rumors, the stories, the fifth, the pictures that are circulating. Muthoni, the drummer queen, has clearly made a big bet on her one life. And after meeting her and seeing her zip off in her silver Mercedes-Benz, it's obviously paying off. Muthoni's latest single is Baby Don't Go. Convenient, since we have to go. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you all tomorrow here on The World.
PRI, Public Radio International.